and welcome to the 8th episode of the Confluence Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. Joining today, as always, Mark Keller, CEO and CIO of Confluence. We are recording this podcast on March 10th. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate question and answer sessions that Mark and I have participated in for the past 25, and that's conservative. It's probably even more than that now. To submit questions, email us at mailbag@confluence.com. Each month, we'll select four or five of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions we receive. Mark and I will address them. So without further ado, let's tackle the first one. We're only going to do four today, and that's because the first one's probably going to take a bit. The question is, how do you think this current conflict with Iran will play out? What takeaways have you seen thus far? Well, this is one of those questions that could look really painfully out of date in just a few days. So it's a little bit brave going on this. I have a number of podcasts I listen to, and they've all been sort of dancing around this issue because things are so fluid. But the first thing I'd like to look at is what really hasn't worked. For most of my career, if you thought something bad was going to happen, buying long-duration treasuries was kind of the go-to. And they hadn't killed you, but they really haven't made you any money. Precious metals have frankly disappointed to some extent as well, and the Swiss franc actually hasn't rallied all that much. Mark, any of the other ones that you've been looking at? Or
not really. I mean, honestly, the oil stock, given the sensitivity to the location of this war, the oil stocks performed pretty well for the 2 months going into this. Mm-hmm. So, and since yesterday morning, and we're recording this on Tuesday, March 10th, since yesterday morning, they, you know, really haven't rallied that much. So they've kind of, maybe they anticipated this. Who knows? But no, there's been relatively little ways to hedge this, at least in the short run.
Yep. A lot of what we're seeing is sort of buy rumor, sell fact. We saw treasuries rally going into this, and then we've seen yields rise since then. As you point out with oil stocks, kind of seeing the same thing. And you could argue perhaps precious metals as well. The thing always you have to keep in mind about precious metals is that if things really get bad, precious metals go down because people sell what they can, not what they should. And if there's a liquidity event out there, we could be seeing people selling gold to raise liquidity. We don't know. Liquidity events are usually known about in hindsight. Something blows up, somebody goes bankrupt, and then you realize why they were selling gold. But I think the key thing to this conflict that we're in is uncertainty about its duration. I spend a lot of time listening to various podcasts, listen to a couple podcasts about the whole transportation issue. As many of you know, Iran's use of drones have added an element to the Strait of Hormuz. For most of my career as an energy analyst, closing the Strait of Hormuz was always the nightmare scenario. The idea being that some kind of conflicts, you know, Iran or some other party would decide, we're just going to shut this off. And the usual two tools to do that would be naval mines and missiles. Well, the U.S. Navy's pretty good at sweeping mines. And the trouble with short-of-ship missiles is you really only get one shot. You know, the U.S. will see where the missile was launched, it'll leave a signature, they'll immediately strike it, and odds are that launching that missile is a suicide mission for the crew that did it. Drones are a completely different factor. They don't leave a signature. They're cheap to produce. You can send scads of them. And so if you're a ship captain with a tanker laden with oil and you're thinking about running the Strait, first off, even if you can get insurance, which can be hard, let's say you're fully insured, you take the run, your ship gets sunk. Well, great. You get compensated for losing your ship and you get compensated for the cargo, but it's going to be 3 years before you get a new ship. In the meantime, you're kind of out of business. Now, if this is going to be a two-year war, the price difference between oil within the Strait of Hormuz and outside of the Strait of Hormuz will get so wide that, you know, you're going to take a run at it. Hope you get through. If this is going to end next week, you'd be out of your mind to do that. So that's one element that has crept up. Another element that is not being talked about enough is that you're starting to see oil production shut down with some of the Persian Gulf states. Iraq is already shutting in production. Qatar has had to shut down its natural gas liquefaction. With oil, when you shut in a well, it can take at best a couple of months to get it restarted. At worst, you may never be able to make that field produce again. And this is starting to get quite dangerous. What has kept markets kind of pretty much on keel, I mean, all things considered, this has been a relatively benign market response, is the expectation this will be short. And to me, that is what everything hinges on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am kind of amazed, actually, the optimism that the market has that this will be short. You and I have both, you know, before we got into this business, we were both history people, and we've continued to be history people, and we know that when a war starts, there's no way of knowing how it's going to end, where it's going to go, how long it's going to take. And I think the markets have been extraordinarily optimistic here. There are a large array of options, one of which a handful of people are talking about, but not enough, is that this follows the path of the Yom Kippur War of 1973. And you and I were speaking this morning, and we were thinking, does no one remember that? Now, I know you and I are old. Okay, we get that. But, you know, I was just starting my senior year of high school when that broke out, and I remember it pretty well. You know, there we had a response to that relatively short war was an oil embargo, but things kind of spun out of control economically worldwide after that. It was a true energy crisis. Now, here, no one's talking about embargoes, but we are talking about the same effect. That is, as you were just saying, energy getting shut in, can't restart, oil refineries and transmission facilities having to be shut down. The effect is the same. It ushered in a time of energy crisis and rising inflation. Rising inflation because the cost of energy finds its way into the cost of everything. People forget it's not just things that energy feedstocks, you know, it's the cost. You know, you can't make or transport anything without energy. And this war is kind of playing out in a way similar. I'm not yet to the place where I'm saying this is the highest probability scenario, but it is a probability that is not irrelevant or immaterial. It seems to me people need to kind of understand that. Now, what happened to these various asset classes then? Well, long-duration treasuries ultimately got crushed because of that rising inflation that, you know, frankly, monetary authorities are kind of helpless. They don't have a lot of tools to deal with the cost of everything going up because the cost of energy goes up. Precious metals were very volatile, but ultimately performed very well in that environment. The Swiss franc, going down your list, did extremely well during that environment.
Yeah, the dollar got really weak.
The dollar got weak during that time frame. Money was rushing into other issues. The dollar is more dominant today, it seems to me, but it still could get weak. Energy investments did extremely well. Everyone kept wondering when the oil stocks were going to stop going up. They didn't stop going up until the early 80s. So it turned out to be a pretty good long-term investment. Back then, energy stocks were the AI tech stocks of today. They didn't stop until they were about 30% of the S&P, which folks have a hard time understanding today.
Yeah. What's it now, about 4?
Yeah, about 4. It was 3 recently. Yeah. It was one-tenth of
its... It's on a tear.
Yeah, yeah. And, but... I you know, this is, you know, in our business, we have to think about what can go wrong all the time. And sure, there's a lot of what can go wrongs that are such low probability. We can dismiss them pretty easily. The 1973 to 1981 scenario is no longer an immaterial probability, in my view. And yeah, we got to keep our kind of minds on that issue, because it just seems that nobody is, almost nobody is talking about this.
Well, I remember when you and I are close to the same age, you're somewhat older, wouldn't know to look at us. But I do remember in 73, I hadn't been driving very long. And what was common for teenagers in that era was to get a car and go drive around. You know, you didn't have social media. So if you're going to meet up with people, you generally go to the local drive-in and hang out and hope to meet somebody. So you needed a car. and that got really expensive. But I remember, you know, my parents and, you know, they would talk to the guy that ran the local service station who was probably the only oil expert in the vicinity. It was a small town. And he was always like, oh, no, gasoline's going back to 19 cents a gallon. You just watch. It never did. It was a game changer. And whether or not this one will be really comes down to, is this going to end quickly? And one of the arguments against it ending quickly is that it appears to me that Iran views this as an existential threat. When an outside power says, well, our goal is regime change, you have to take that seriously. And, you know, I think for years the thought was, well, if Iran thinks this is regime change, then they're going to start trying to launch nuclear warheads, which they may or may not have. They probably don't. That's really not true. Closing the Strait of Hormuz was really the response, and starting to attack the oil infrastructure of its neighboring states. Because if you're going down, you're going to bring everybody else with you. And that's what I fear in all this, is that, yeah, the U.S. may decide, okay, we've met our objectives, we're done here, but if Iran keeps fighting, I don't know what options the United States has. I mean, if it leaves the region, Iran will probably destroy the oil infrastructure of the neighboring countries, and you're going to lose approximately 20% of the world's oil supply.
No, and we can't leave the region for that reason. I mean, let's talk a little bit about responses. We've already seen China put export controls on. That happened last week. We've seen a few other smaller Asian countries, including South Korea, put price controls on energy. We're kind of following that old playbook.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real 70s mm-hmm. playbook.
And so this is a form of hoarding, national hoarding, that could get worse and leaves some other nations that are energy poor, you know, volitionally energy poor because they were trying to go green, mm-hmm. In a real bad spot. This is most of the EU. This is Australia, New Zealand. I was astounded to read something this morning that both Australia and New Zealand have recently shut down their last oil refineries, which means they are completely dependent on imported product. They've been shutting them down in California, and California gets a not immaterial amount of its refined product from China, which just put the kibosh on that a little while ago. We're kind of following that old playbook, that hoarding playbook.
Yes,
which creates its own set of problems.
Yeah, you know, I've done quite a bit of research on the whole process of the creation of the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. Now, Americans are all pretty familiar with, but there are actually the OECD countries participate in a global strategic reserve system with the idea that the U.S. and others will make releases as a group. And the IEA, which is a subdivision, the International Energy Agency, is a subdivision of the OECD, will inform the participating countries where to send the oil to where it's most needed. Now, keep in mind that oil has been purchased by the taxpayers of that sovereign state. The temptation is going to be that, yeah, we're going to do a strategic reserve, but you can't export it. And once that gets done, then the countries that are bereft of oil are going to know that no one's coming to save them. And hoarding then will become the norm. And that's exactly what we saw during the 1970s. If you look at the correlation between U.S. commercial crude oil inventories and price, they were positively correlated at about 92%. That's not normal. A normal market, inventory and price are inversely correlated, which makes sense. That's the purpose of having strategic reserves that could inadvertently get short-circuited in a world of resource nationalism. We don't want to alarm anyone unduly. Like I said, we're doing this on the 10th. This whole discussion is going to be moot if in 2 or 3 days we end up seeing a ceasefire. And hopefully we will. But if this continues to go longer, the markets are underpricing the risk that we could be seeing.
Commodities in general did rather well during
mm-hmm.
that time frame.
Well, and if you look at how commodities have behaved, another area that has been depressed that's really started to do well are grains. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's not just oil out of the Strait. A lot of fertilizer mm-hmm. comes out of that region. These countries have realized that value add to their energy is smart. And the world has appreciated that because it helps keep food prices low. Farmers could be in a very difficult spot. You know, if fertilizer prices become really rich, they may simply decide, well, we're going to plant, we're just not going to fertilize as much, and we're going to see lower yields. You know, there's a reason the Fed, in its inflation policy target, excludes food and energy. It's not that food and energy aren't important, it's that they can't do much about it. And I'm watching with great interest what's going on in the grain markets. It's a difficult market to participate in. The fertilizer stocks potentially could do okay, except the problem is their feedstock is natural gas, and that's not going down either. So it may just be that the best outcome with this is higher corn and soybean prices.
Again, we're not trying to overly alarm people. We just want to be straight with our listeners about the kind of things that can happen here. We've already seen those stocks advance a little bit. North American fertilizer companies could find themselves in a relative advantage, even though the price of natural gas is going up. The cost of gas here will be a lot lower. Yeah, we were looking at a list the other day of things go through the Gulf, and the commodity that is most exposed to the Gulf, of all things, is sulfur. Yeah. 45-50% of the world's sulfur goes through the Straits of Hormuz.
And guess what we use sulfur for, listeners? Mining. Believe it or not, metals mining. It's used in the leaching process. Sulfuric acid.
Yes. Ask your favorite chemical engineer what sulfuric acid is used for, and the answer is almost everything.
Yeah.
Most of us know about sulfur is it smells bad, but the fact is it's an essential building block for all kinds of chemical reactions, and that's one of the reasons why, if this does drag on, and I pray it doesn't, but if it does drag on, you could see a lot of costs go up, and that's why one of the reasons why Bill and I are not terribly optimistic about the long duration bonds if this keeps going. If you're inclined to hedge here, that's not one I'd choose. It's probably my least favorite hedge. I'm happy sticking with precious metals and other commodities. I think energy stocks, even though they're up a little, they're still pretty cheap. You know, if you want to hedge, I think those are much better hedges than the bond market.
The other thing to keep in mind about these things is, you know, at some point this will get resolved. If it gets resolved in a way where the nature of the Iranian regime changes significantly, that will probably be ultimately a pretty bearish event for oil. It's just that it's a little bit like talking about raising children and saying, well, between 8 and 20, it's going to be really bad. It won't last too long. And you're thinking to yourself, 12 years? Lovely. Getting to point B could be traumatic.
In the long run, several years out, this is really bearish for energy. Mm-hmm. You get, we always say in the commodity business, the cure for high prices is high prices. Eventually, it brings massive supplies up. It just takes a while to get there.
Yep.
And I would rather play the long side of those markets right now than the short side.
Well, we could probably spend another hour on this, but let's not. Second question. Clients are putting money to work in sector index-based ETFs, thinking they're getting broad diversification, when really a handful of names are driving the market sector performance. If we have a pullback and these investors go to cash, will this cause any issues? Well, you know, this gets back to that whole passive argument and the cap weight versus equal weight allocation. One way that investors can address this is through allocating to the unfavored sectors. And we've seen some of that this year, the whole market rotation. The other is to consider equal weight portfolios in indexing as opposed to cap weighted. You lose some performance at times, but in the long run, you actually tend to do better and with a little less volatility.
We've been seeing a fair amount of rotation. It looks to me like this heavy tech concentration is now, which has been a great thing for passive investors. Looks like it's starting to be a weight. I just pulled up one of the big index funds this morning, the Vanguard Index Fund, VOO. 40% of the portfolio are the top 10 companies in it. That's extraordinary. Now, the top 10 companies make up 11 stocks because Google has two classes of stocks in there. And of those top 10 companies, only the last two, the two smallest of them, are not tech. and that's Berkshire Hathaway and Lilly. So if you knock those out, it's still the top eight companies are 37% of that mutual fund and of the S&P fund, and they're all tech. That's a concentration that most investors probably, if they had their choice, wouldn't put 37% of their funds in one industry unless they are just super bullish. But passive investing doesn't give you that option. Right. You just take what it gives you, and most passive investment options are cap-weighted.
Passive investment, as flows go in, lead to extremes. And the governor on it, frankly, are recessions. And we have had policies in place. I mean, we haven't had a recession since 2008, with the exception of COVID. And without COVID, we wouldn't have had one. And the NBER dates recessions, broke its own rules by giving that a two-month recession. Mm-hmm. You know, recessions are supposed to be 6 to 8 month events. So we've been living in a world for a long time without recessions. And
people start liquidating. It all kind of runs in reverse. Yeah. And that's why recessions are, and the bear markets associated with them, I think, leave that area, that sector of the market exposed. The rotation that began in late October and is continuing, it looks to me like it's got legs. Looks like this could continue for a while. And I'm in complete agreement. I think going against what had been a long-term trend looks, you know, like the new trend.
Yeah.
I'm quite comfortable with that because it's a much less expensive part of the market.
Yeah. Third question. I'm going to actually have you cover this one. Any read on private credit, private equity? I know BDCs have been a little weak lately.
Well, there's a lot going on there. You know, there's a lot of press dumping on the private credit industry right now and BDCs, and they've been weak. I think there's some misinformation too. I'll just kind of go through. Vesta. What are the problems? Well, one of the problems is lower interest rates. Private credit loans, but we should make clear, BDCs are the publicly traded arm of the private credit industry. Most of its private credit is private investments, where you have to pretty much be a big fish to get in there. The institution, although there are some private credit vehicles available to individuals. The BDCs are the publicly traded arm. But these loans are tied to short-term interest rates, to SOFR in particular. And so when short-term interest rates go up, the yields go up. And when they go down, the yields go down. And, you know, the Fed's been cutting rates recently. Yields, short rates have been coming down. SOFR's coming down. And so are the yields on the investments inside these pools. And that's why the dividends have been coming down a little bit. And if Trump gets his wish, and he gets a Fed that brings short rates down a lot, you're going to see the yields on these things come down. So that's one of the things going on. The other thing that's really been hammering these prices in the market is what's going on, getting back to what we were talking about, Mark, tech stocks, AI. We've gone from being just fascinated, you know, just gobsmacked about how wonderful AI is, to now the market trend is to worry about the financial damage it's going to do. And this has been hitting certain industries in particular, none more than the software and software stocks. And guess what? A lot of BDCs own debt of software companies. And what's happening to those debt? Well, same thing. The market prices of that debt are going down, just like the market prices of the stocks are going down. And that's pressuring NAVs down as well. There is another problem which people have been talking about. It's not as big as you think yet, and that's credit problems. There's a handful of BDCs, handful of private credit funds that are having credit problems. And they're kind of, you know, they're getting the headlines. That's not become a universal thing yet. The big well-run BDCs haven't had that. But still, that's all part of the thing. So what is the impact of this? Well, you know, some investors want out because they don't like prices going down. In the public BDCs, it's pretty easy. You just put in a sell order and there you go. The only issue is the price you get. It's just like selling a stock in a bear market. You're going to get less than you would selling it in the bull market. So, you know, there have been prices going down, but at least you can get your money back. This private BDCs, though, and the private credits funds, guess what? There's not good liquidity. There's almost no liquidity. Most of these funds have gates, exit gates, only let so many people through at a time. They usually only let about 5% per quarter. And this creates a lot of angst for folks. That's kind of what's going on there. The thing where I disagree, and that's all, this is all happening, we're watching it happening. What I disagree with when people start saying there's a lot of systemic risk here, I don't think there's a lot. And this is my biggest argument I have with the press that I'm reading in the financial press, warning about all kinds of crazy things, awful things happening. The investors, by and large, are equity investors in these funds. They could lose their equity, but equity doesn't have the same kind of losses, don't have the kind of ripple effect that you get with debt. It's not a highly leveraged industry. Because of that relatively low leverage, we didn't have any BDCs, for instance, go bankrupt during the great financial crisis. So who's lending to them? Well, the banks are lending to them. But the bank debt to them is secured, and it's kind of like margin debt. It's tied to the value, and so when the values fall, you know, they've been coming down, you either have to put up more capital or liquidate some of your assets. And some we've been seeing some of the funds sell some of their books of business. Is this a risky form of lending? No, it's not really that risky to the banks. Margin debts actually, I mean, and they lend to broker-dealers, for instance, for margin loans. It's actually a fairly profitable and secure form of lending. It's callable in 24 hours, usually. That's what broker call rates are. These are not quite usually as quickly callable, but the creditor has to put up capital or liquidate. So it's pretty, I just don't see it. So who are the losers if this gets worse? The equity investors and unsecured lenders who are all usually big institutions. In both cases, they're big, you know, institutional pension funds, foundations, that kind of stuff.
What private credit solves is the problem of the runnable funding base. Mm-hmm. And the way it does that is you can't get your money out.
No, that's the way it's designed.
And so what do they offer in return? Higher interest rates. And interestingly enough, the psychological comfort that the marks don't change very often. So they're telling you, oh no, it's worth 100 cents on the dollar. Now, anyone who's been in the market more than an hour is going to realize that prices change all the time. It's a useful fiction. But if you think it's more than a useful fiction, you're a fool. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily bad. I mean, when a bank makes a loan, I remember my first experience of this was when I was in banking. I worked in the international department of a bank, and they had lent money to Latin America, and they had just done a restructuring. And so all these loans after the restructuring were carried at 100 cents on the dollar. And then one of the money center banks out of the blue just reserved up to 50%. So the value dropped in half overnight. I mean, there was wailing and gnashing of teeth, but the reality is that mark was probably about right. These loans weren't going to get paid back, and eventually it forced the resolution of them. Again, the sophisticated investors are buying these things know that in general, at any given moment, the loans are not worth 100 cents on the dollar, but they tend to be fairly short-term loans. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 3 years or 5 years, when the term's up, probably get your money back. And if not, they get refinanced, and you know, you can decide whether you want to participate or not.
Mm-hmm. And as we saw during the great financial crisis, yeah, a lot of the equity prices went down in the BDCs, and the same thing was happening on the private side. And because there was a lot of angst, it was a deep recession. Most of them came bouncing back on the other side.
Yep.
And it's we all know why this industry kind of has grown so rapidly. Coming out of there, the federal regulators put so many restrictions on banks, they couldn't really make these kind of loans anymore. And so the demand for credit was still high, and this industry has grown dramatically as a result. And it's probably a better place for those loans to sit than in the bank. So I don't have too many issues with it.
The third order effect here could be that if you end up with a really nasty credit event, that equity holders will just simply not fund this industry anymore. And, you know, part of what helped the banks work is that they had a lot of dumb funding. You know, you have to have a bank account. You know, you don't have to put your money into a private credit fund. And so that's one potential outcome, that maybe you only get to go to this well once, and then it takes a while for that to be able to replenish it. And then the lending would go to banks. But, you know, then you've got the problem of the of the runs.
Mm-hmm. So we will see. It has a place in sophisticated investors' portfolios for the income side. But there's no doubt there's a level of market volatility that you've got to be comfortable with.
Well, last question is kind of an interesting one. What's your opinion on the future of financial advice, specifically in our industry? As artificial intelligence reaches the level of super intelligence, will it steal market share? Can young advisors guard against this? Is it even possible? Well, my first response was, yeah, you guys are all doomed, but I'm kidding. I think one of the things that continues to come up is artificial intelligence gives the illusion of human contact. And we've had cases where people have done really bad things because they've been convinced by whatever AI system they're talking to that they've come up with a cure for cancer or something. But the reality is people want to talk to another person that they trust. And a good financial advisor is really a financial psychiatrist. They help people figure out what their risk tolerance is, how their risk tolerance changes as they age, and it has to be unique to that person. So it's hard work. And AI, look, is AI going to be able to assist in that? You bet. Is it going to replace people? There's always people who are going to believe they don't need to see another human. I mean, you go to the grocery store, you can get through the checkout without actually talking to a checker. But the reality is, as long as you understand what your role is, you're probably going to be fine.
Well, this is a trust business. People have a hard time trusting machines to do anything but basic data acquisition, data delivery, things like that. This is not a new question. We've been hearing this for most of our careers because it's technology grows, and it kind of grows in waves. As soon as you get a new algorithm, a new company comes along with do-it-yourself tools, you say, well, is the advice industry doomed? And no, it just keeps growing because as people accumulate wealth, they get more serious about it in the sense that they want advice. They want to be able to trust trustworthy people, and that's where it comes. We're nowhere near what is called term singularity, where a machine thinks just like a human being. The large language models that run all these AIs, they're based on...
They're stochastic parrots.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking that this, I sent you and a few other people an article this morning, and I wrote, this is a good read on the energy, and then I stopped, and the AI behind our email system put in the word situation.
Yeah.
Energy situation. Okay, that's what I was going to write. How did it know that? It knew that because it looks at a zillion emails in human beings writing, and they know most of the time when you start with those words, the word situation is the next one. Now, I could have crossed it up and typed status, but the fact is that's how AI works. It gathers all this way of human thinking and reasoning and kind of guesses what the next thing's going to be. Well, there's a problem with that is that the most likely next step sometimes doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And this is where human reasoning still has a leg up on the current situation. This is why people have a hard time trusting AI or trusting algorithms or any of this, computerized investments with wealth once you get to a certain point in life and a certain size. I would also point out that we were talking about this the other day because, this, as I mentioned earlier, the financial damage that AI can do is hitting a lot of industries. And one of the industries that we happen to have several investments in on the equity side around here are the insurance brokers, an industry that's not that far removed from financial advisors. And people are worried about that industry as well. And it occurred to me as we were talking about that there's one thing that AI can't do in that area, and that's client acquisition. Oh, yeah, there's people who will always want to do something themselves. Mm-hmm. But again, you get to a serious size and you start thinking, maybe I need some help with this. I got an insurance situation that's very complex. I'm not just going to go online and start typing. I think I need some help. I need an expert here. And human beings are good at acquiring clients that need them. And AI can't go out searching for clients. That's another reason why I think the industry we're so familiar with, the financial advisor industry, isn't going away.
To me, the societal hurdle is that AI, and this has actually been true of automation for the past century, it increasingly takes away the routine and leaves humans to do the tail risk. The trick is, for a human to learn to tail risk usually occurs by doing the routine and figuring out the patterns behind the routine. Now, AI can figure out the patterns, but to date, it can't intuit. If it comes up with a completely unique situation, it starts hallucinating. Humans don't do that. And what we haven't figured out is, how do we turn people into critical thinking, have given the ability to do critical thinking without doing the routine work first? That's the hurdle we haven't figured out. And I don't have an answer to it, but I can tell you that's what I think the real danger is that we can, you know, it's like the autopilot that works so well except when there's this certain arrangement of thunderstorms and you need an experienced pilot there, and the pilot has no way of getting the experience.
Well, there's a whole lot, in recent years especially, there's a whole lot of general aviation crashes, unfortunately, that are due to the fact that the pilots, often young pilots, are so dependent upon the autopilot that when you get into situations where the autopilot can't handle it, they don't know how to fly the plane because they are, you know, their stick and rudder skills just aren't good enough to fly without autopilot. Well, you know, that's a danger in all aspects of technology. And one we have to be careful of when it comes to managing our clients' assets. Yeah, technology and AI is no different. It's going to make us much more productive by doing those routine things well in every financial company. Little ones like ours to great big banks are going to be using it to become more productive. But to make those front-end big decisions, no. We better know how to fly the plane without the autopilot.
Yep. Well, we've been going for a while now, Mark. I think it's a good time to close it up for today. Again, as a reminder, if you want to submit a question, send one to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.